I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Asher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where the pandemic, the climate crisis, and collapse are just a state of mind.
This is producer Melody Travers. In this season of Crazy Town, Jason, Asher, and Rob are exploring the watershed moments in history that have led humanity into the cascading crises we face in the 21st century. Today's episode investigates how something simple and useful, positive thinking, has been contorted into a pseudo-religion and profit-sucking industry that gets in the way of pursuing good policies. The watershed moment took place in the year 1830. At the time, the estimated carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere was 284 parts per million, and the global human population was 1.04 billion.
Hey, Jason and Rob, I wanted to get your advice on something.
Yeah, you've come to the right place for good advice.
So, Kirsten and I are thinking about having another kid. Our boys are getting older. My oldest is about to get his driver's license. We have a lot of energy still. I feel like we have a lot of wisdom to impart. I'm really looking forward to being 68 when they graduate high school.
Yeah. But wait. Can you still do this? I mean, are you guys...
Oh, you're thinking about my vasectomy.
I think so.
You know, you've heard of those rare cases where they get sort of naturally reversed. I think if I think positively enough about it.
Something will push through.
I don't know what you're on about with this negativity. Like, if he thinks about it hard enough, he could probably, like...
He thinks about it hard enough. That's a good one, buddy.
He could shrink the size of his sperm, and they could get through that knot that got tied in his vas deferens.
Don't mention shrinkage.
We just lost everybody listening. No, I mean, I'll be honest with you. The only reason I'm even thinking about this is because I've got a great name in mind.
Okay.
For a child, girl or boy, doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah, girl or boy. Okay, I like this.
Quimby.
Yeah.
And Quimby, because they will be hugely, hugely successful in life.
Yeah, how's like that? The mayor on The Simpsons, Mayor Quimby.
Okay.
I am a Cher's child, and I was born of a vasectomy.
Well, actually...
Who the hell's Quimby?
The reason we wanted to name this child Quimby is because of the person behind today's watershed moment.
Mayor Quimby is today's watershed? Oh.
No. Damn. It's a different Quimby.
Okay.
So let's go back in time, okay? Almost 200 years ago. God, time is getting away from us.
Yeah.
Think about it. 1830. 28-year-old Phineas Parkhurst Quimby.
Jeez, they don't make names like they used to.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mayor Quimby's name on The Simpsons was actually Mayor Joseph Fitzgerald O'Malley Fitzpatrick O'Donnell the Edge.
The Edge.
Quimby.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's just every season they added an extra name.
The internet tells me all kinds of good things.
So our buddy Phineas was a clockmaker from Maine. But Phineas was dying of tuberculosis.
Big deal in those days.
Kind of rough.
It's coming back.
Quimby's doctors were trying to treat him, but they're giving him meds that actually were making him worse.
Yeah, typical of the time.
So, you know, one day, we don't know what day exactly it was, in 1830, he was desperate, and he got advice from a friend of his who said, you know, that he had gone on a long horseback ride when he was sick with something, and that healed him. So Quimby was like, I'm going to do this. But he was too weak to actually get on a horse. So he got in a carriage instead, you know, and he rode all day through Maine.
So he's getting the horse gases.
Yeah. Maybe it
took a while for it to really work. It's the exhaust system of the horse.
But, you know, at the end of the day, he was so exhausted, wasn't feeling any better. He needed the help of a local farmer to, like, turn the carriage around for him. And then something miraculous happened to him in that moment. And he wrote later, he said, at the time that the farmer started his horse, which makes it sound like it's a fucking car.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I was so weak, quote, I was so weak I could scarcely lift my whip. That's great. I'm sure that horse was disappointed.
Quimby is like Indiana Jones, just carries a whip with him.
Right, exactly.
I'm going to ask for a whip for my birthday.
Please
go ahead,
don't.
Keep going.
But excitement took possession of my senses, and I drove the horse as fast as he could go, uphill and down, until I reached home. And when I got to the stable, I felt as strong as I ever did. And it was that experience, that moment in 1830, that led to a new movement called New Thought, or what some people call positive thinking. And that is the watershed moment today because it transformed American society.
He probably had a little microaneurysm or something like that, but anyhow.
Way to ruin
it. We don't really know.
Maybe he got some fresh air for a change, and or maybe horse farts really do cure tuberculosis.
So a lot of people don't know Quimby now, but he wound up devoting his life to the development of a whole set of beliefs that he documented. These were published posthumously after he died, but over the rest of his life, he became a healer for something like 12,000 patients.
Oh, gosh.
Teaching them this sort of new thought, positivity. I'm going to call it mumbo jumbo.
Okay. What? So you got to explain this new thoughtism going on. What's the deal with
sure.
it?
Sure. There are a couple of key concepts here. You know, you won't be surprised sort of like the source of this. This is... For him, it was really about disease being a manifestation of negative thoughts and beliefs. In a sense, not a figment of our imagination, but something that we construct. And I'm just going to quote something that he wrote in this book that was published after his death, writing in the third person about himself, which, by the way,
I love that. That's
always
a
warning sign.
Yeah.
Right?
Is he like a professional athlete in the NBA or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Writing in the third person, here's a paragraph like Quimby wrote. Dr. Quimby asserts and expects to prove that what is called disease is not a cause but an effect. He says that thoughts are like the shock of a galvanic battery, that they are directed by some wisdom outside of the individual, and that these thoughts are deposited according to the direction and bring about a phenomenon. This phenomenon, which he calls an idea, quote-unquote, is named disease, quote-unquote. He says that every idea, whether of disease or anything else, is a combination of thoughts, and that every person is responsible to himself for his ideas and must suffer the penalty of them. In treating the sick, Dr. Quimby introduces the subjects of religion, politics, and all ideas, the discussion of which agitates society. These, he says, contain fear and excite the mind, which by a false direction brings about the phenomenon called disease. He takes every patient as he finds him and commences as a teacher with a pupil, destroying his error by correcting every idea that affects his health.
That's pretty long. Can you make a tweet out of that for me, please?
I think if you wanted to make a synonym for that, one word, it's the guy puts his hand on your head, pushes you, and yells, "Hailed!" That's pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Well, no, there's a little bit more to this, which is that what you think, the ideas that you have, form your experience, right? So you have negative ideas. You, in a sense, disease becomes manifested.
I mean, it wasn't until the late 1850s with the work of Louis Pasteur that we had the germ theory. So what was this, 1830?
Right, so you forgive him?
I mean, there's a little bit, but, you know, as soon as all this germ theory comes out, because tuberculosis, for God's sakes, they figured out what that really was.
So yeah. Quimby had basically 20 good years, is what you're saying, before.
And then we should have been saying,
I hate to destroy that, pop your bubble, but even after Pasteur, this stuff took off. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're not kidding. You know, there's a whole bunch of documented quotes that I'm lucky I've got in front of me, and I'm going to put a couple in front of you guys to read. I mean, to me, these are a little better than Quimby's. Quimby's is pretty hard to follow. I mean, that's all over the place, but some of these, this is just the positive thinking gurus. We got to go through some of them. So I'm going to read one from Rhonda Byrne, who did the book The Secret, and she says, "Just like the law of gravity, the law of attraction never slips up. You don't see pigs flying because the law of gravity made a mistake and forgot to apply gravity to pigs that day. Likewise, there are no exclusions to the law of attraction. If something came to you, you drew it with prolonged thought. The law of attraction is precise."
What the hell is the law of attraction? I hate it. I hate it.
That's a key concept okay, that comes from Quimby's stuff. Yeah. You know, okay. You not only are you bringing disease to you with negative thoughts, you can attract positive results in your life.
Oh, I see.
You know, through positive thinking.
Okay.
So, Jason, I've queued one up for you here by Wallace Waddles. What a great name.
Now, you want me to read this Wallace Waddles?
Is that with a T or a D, Waddles?
Two T's.
Okay.
Yeah. Waddle.
Out of his book, The Science of Getting Rich from 1910.
Great title. There's a lot of scientism in
scientificity.
Yes, in all of this. Anyway, okay, I'll read this quote. Thanks, Rob, for setting this up for me. And I had nothing to do with this quote, but now I get to read. Quote, "No one is kept in poverty by a shortness in the supply of riches."
Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
"There is more than enough for all. Nature is an inexhaustible storehouse of riches. The supply will never run out. Original substance is alive with creative energy. When the supply of building material is exhausted, more will be produced. When the soil is exhausted so that foodstuffs and materials for clothing will no longer grow upon it, it will be renewed, or more soil will be made. When all the gold and silver has been dug from the earth, more will be produced from the farmless. When the jug of milk runs out in my refrigerator downstairs, it shall be automatically replaced." That's such bullshit.
I think you went further than Waddles. That,
well, that's because it's nonsense.
No. It is true. What? You know about those Amazon buttons that you can get, right? You stick that on your fridge, you push the button, and it shows up.
There you go.
What's wrong?
Oh, you're right. Okay, the milk will show up.
Waddles anticipated Amazon.
When my book lacks a large passage of bullshit, more bullshit will suddenly appear in my book.
All right, well, I gotta throw another one out from Wallace.
Much.
I'm digging Waddles.
Oh, yeah, Waddles again. I gotta read this book like cover to cover.
Okay, here's another one. "It is the desire of God that you should get rich. He wants you to get rich because he can express himself better through you if you have plenty of things to use in giving him expression."
I love that Waddles knows what God wants you to do or be. That's
you gotta bling out that ride. Because that is you telling God. You're giving a gift to God when you do that.
Take it home, Rob.
One more quote, because we don't want to go on too long with this, but here's one from Norman Vincent Peale, which we'll get into him more in a bit too, from his book, The Power of Positive Thinking in 1952. "It is my conviction that the principles of Christianity, scientifically utilized, can develop an uninterrupted and continuous flow of energy into the human mind and body." Uninterrupted flow.
Yeah. It's that interesting, all this stuff about energy and material
and
resources.
Scientifically and all. It's like a blend of sort of religion and scientific materialism, but it's mishmashed together in some bizarre ways.
Sounds good. So, look, I think we got to be a little careful here. We may have already blown this.
There's any listeners left.
It's so easy to just sit here and ridicule this stuff. And God knows, I would love to do that. It would be enjoyable. But I think what we should really do is talk about, well, why we're bringing this up. Why is this a watershed, this Quimby ride, all this stuff? Why is it so important to why we find ourselves in Crazy Town?
And let me just say, too, it's okay if you like one of these books or you got something out of it. But, just realizing the difference between some of this made-up stuff, like the gold will reappear once we take it, versus, there's a piece of wisdom I could use. So, I've read some of these things in the past, and I find them, you can get some useful things.
I guess it's a question of how literally you take them, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's worth sort of talking about how this new thoughtism, positive thinking has grown in popularity, how it's spread through different aspects of society over the decades. It really started, as Barbara Ehrenreich talks about in her book, she wrote a great book on this topic called Brightsided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. And she talked about sort of the early years of new thought movement as really being something that spoke to the needs of women in particular. So, America, at its core, has sort of this Calvinistic Puritan heritage, right? Jason, you know this really well.
Being Bradford, Mayflower family. I come from a long stock of Puritans. I'm very proud of it.
And you know, Calvinism really taught that one spot in heaven was predestined, and your primary task while living was to, like, get rid of sinful thoughts that are a sure sign of damnation that are going to keep you from that.
Right? I read The Scarlet Letter. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great book, actually.
Great book, yeah. It's probably banned right now, but anyhow.
It'll get there. Yeah. It'll get there, because it talks about sex. Hard work and manual labor was, like, the only relief that people had from this, like, oppression, this sort of self-examination. And it was like idleness and pleasure were considered sins, right, in Calvinism. But industrial age kind of took away many of women's traditional jobs in the home, right? And they're left with, like, nothing to do but pass the time, but to torture themselves. And it's really interesting.
What do they mean by that, torture?
Over yourself? Their sinful idleness, right? So they're feeling bad about
not working enough.
Working enough, I guess, you know?
Okay.
And there is actually a really interesting phenomenon that sort of spread, in a kind of an epidemic that spread across middle-class women.
Yeah, it must have been the middle class.
There's like
urban middle-class women who are getting
the
initial products of the industrial age.
You know, I think they talk about these things as like the vapors or invalidism.
Okay.
In nervousness, you know, anxiety in women. Like in doctors, there really was kind of an epidemic of this, and doctors just didn't know what to do with it. They couldn't treat it because it really was a psychological, emotional manifestation.
A response to living in a way that you were never meant to live.
Or wasn't consistent with the values that you grew up in. So Quimby's stuff, he actually identified Calvinism as a source of many of his patients' ills, you know, and he convinced them that the universe is actually benevolent, right? I mean, think about the change there, right? Like, instead of saying, basically, you're sinful.
You are preordained to either go to hell or heaven.
So the idea of a kinder and gentler God, you know, was very appealing to I guess, particularly middle-class women at the time.
Okay. I mean, Quimby, I haven't really heard of him before this episode, but...
Well, you'll meet my future child.
Okay, exactly. I can't wait. I'm manifesting your sperm finding their way through the vas deferens that are tied off and cauterized.
The three listeners we had left are now gone.
His sperm, you're teaching them how to pole vault across great distances.
they can do it. I'm going to cheer them on. Anyhow, sorry about that, Kirsten. But anyhow, this really then manifested in religious movements that are sort of derived from Quimby's thinking. And the earliest, most famous one is basically one of these patients of Quimby who end up stealing his ideas, and that's Mary Baker Eddy, who at the kind of towards the end of the 19th century founded Christian Science. And for a while there, it was the fastest growing religion in the United States in the early 20th century. And it basically is sort of this rejection of modern medicine and kind of that, you know, to sum it up, it's sort of you can pray your way to health. Mm-hmm. They subscribe to this radical form of philosophical idealism and believing that reality is purely spiritual and the material world is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this ties back to Quimby's, sorry, mispronounced your son's or daughter's name. The disease is a mental error rather than a physical disorder.
Right.
So fascinating.
Well, okay, look, we know that the three of us need to reject our own inner drive to be buttheads here and make fun of everything. So let me pull in America's greatest critical butthead, Mark Twain, to do a bit of
So we can appeal to authority for rejection and being a butthead rather than us doing it ourselves.
Right, yes.
I like that.
Although I'm sure Twain's been... His books are getting burned. Right
now. Yeah, they're probably burning a bunch of
Twain. He's awesome, totally hilarious. He wrote a whole book that's a takedown of Christian Science with the awesome title Christian Science. So
I didn't know that. I'm
going to read you the first third of maybe the best run-on sentence of all time that opens the book. So Mark Twain writes. This last summer, when I was on my way back to Vienna from the appetite cure in the mountains, I fell over a cliff in the twilight and broke some arms and legs and one thing or another, and by good luck was found by some peasants who had lost an ass. So that's the first third of his sentence. But basically, he sets this up where he falls off a 75-foot cliff. He's banging off of boulders all the way down.
Okay.
And this peasant gets him to the farmhouse and consults a doctor. But the doctor is into the Quimby, what'd you say, Mary Barker Eddy Christian Science stuff. And basically, he's complaining that I'm in pain. I've got hunger and thirst. And the doctor's like, oh, I knew he would have those delusions.
Right.
We've got to change his thinking.
Yeah, because the material world doesn't really exist. It's all an illusion. It's all spiritual.
Those some broken arms and legs are not really
They're not
broken.
Really. They're not real. They're not there.
Yeah. Okay. He goes on to do all kinds of cool stuff. Like, he compares the dominance of the new thought movement and sort of like pulling in all these different strands to the way Standard Oil took over.
Yeah, I think he's talking specifically about Christian Science, right? Yeah. Like, there are all these strands of new thought cropping up left and right. And in some ways, you know, he's really attacking Christian Science, specifically Mary Baker Eddy, and I think was kind of comparing her to Rockefeller in the sense of like all these wildcatter oil guys can't figure shit out. You get this guy to come in, like, you know, create this whole system to control it all.
Fascinating.
You know, there are these new spiritual strains or religions, you know, that you can point to that emerge from Quimby, but it also really did work its way into evangelical Protestant churches.
Remember the Bakers?
Tammy Faye and
Jim.
Jim Baker, yeah.
They're still going.
Are they?
Yes.
Well, and so there's this kind of piece of this positive thinking that people call the prosperity gospel.
Yep.
So prosperity gospel, in a sense, is sort of like combining a religious belief, or a belief in this case in a Christian God, with people's pursuit of happiness and material well-being. And interestingly, there are a lot of like very conservative Protestant leaders. This is later, you know, during the New Deal era, who used this prosperity gospel idea in opposition to the New Deal, which was, the New Deal was all about, like, let's provide a floor, a safety net for all of society.
What would Jesus do?
And their thing was basically saying, look, no, actually, you're getting in the way of your relationship with God. God wants you to prosper. You need to have a relationship with God, not the state.
Let me explain. Let me flesh this out.
Yeah.
So the idea here, if I'm following this train of thought, which is difficult to follow because it's batshit crazy, is that you should not have any kind of government program to help people who are destitute and hungry, because if you do that, then they won't turn to God, who, if you believe that you can manifest a relief from your destitution and hunger through a relationship with the Lord, then that will manifest itself. And so this was anti-God because it was trying to feed poor people.
Right. And the truth of the matter is, these guys were anti-government and were using this as an excuse to, or maybe they saw it, I don't know, they saw it as a threat for the role of the church to have the state play. You know,
because these people aren't going to donate money to the church as much if that's not giving them what they want.
Right.
This stuff drives me crazy. I don't know how much you guys know about this character Joel Osteen down in Texas.
I tune in every Sunday.
I mean, he seems to manifest some of this stuff. You know, like he gets on stage. He's got that snap-on hair. Looks like a lion's mane.
There's a look
he's
got, to these guys.
He's got this weird like. Yeah. Like permanent smile plastered across his face.
His wife, she's stunning.
His eyes are like half closed as he goes on. He says stuff like, I want you to stand up and let the light shine on your backside.
Really?
Let that light fill your rectal cavity where it can illuminate all the dark spaces. Then a rainbow of fecal matter can flow into your life and bring you all the gifts and joy you deserve. Hallelujah!
Oh my God, I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. Amen.
So, I jest a little. But I mean, this guy, he has the biggest church in the U.S. He literally has the old basketball arena.
It's that fucking stadium.
Yeah, 16,500 seats.
And he fills it.
What do you mean, a basketball arena?
He bought the old, I think maybe it was the Houston Rockets basketball arena.
They had to, of course, build a better one.
Right.
With more luxury boxes.
Right. I'm surprised.
So I'm glad it's been put to use.
But he fucking fills it. He gets 45,000 people going into that church every weekend.
No, 16,000. Well, maybe. They do multiple.
Yeah, multiple. Okay. Yeah.
That I was not aware of. The guy has a net worth above $50 million. He's doing self-help books. And Asher, you made me aware of this really special product that he's got.
Yeah. So there's something called the Inspiration Cube. Okay, so, you know, we've got these devices now, right? We've got, like, you could talk to Siri on your phone.
Right.
You got Alexa, you know, from Amazon. Well, so he's come out with his own thing, which is called the Inspiration Cube. Maybe I'll just play a little clip from one of his ads.
I don't want to vomit.
It's just waking up.
With the simple push of a button, remove those negative thoughts with a new message to inspire your day.
God is saying to you, you have struggled long enough. Unexpected blessings are coming your way.
Over 400 of Joel's greatest inspirations ever assembled, all on this easy-to-use audio listening cube.
It's all positive. It's not negative. Our lives have changed completely.
There you go. It's all positive. It's not negative, right?
Oh, my God.
The thing is called Joel. It's got his fucking name on it.
Instead of Alexa, it's Joel.
You can listen to Joel all day long if you
want
to.
You can have one named Quimby later.
I want those unexpected things coming my way. Come on. I'm getting you one of those next birthday.
Well, here's what I think is a delicious, scrumptious irony is that, you know, this whole idea that the material world is not real is part of the early new thoughtism or whatever. And yet the prosperity gospel has kind of somehow morphed this into get rich quick.
Right.
So that you can tithe more and more. And that's what it's ridiculous, right? It's not just about your mind controls your bodily health, but also your wealth. And so this ends up spilling over into American business culture, and there's all these not only these probably seminars for executives to go to, whatever, to be incredibly domineering and net positive, yeah. But there's also a lot of get rich shit schemes for the masses.
I think that's quick, not get rich.
Yeah, get rich quick schemes for the masses. In an early version was a book by Bruce Barton. This is in 1925.
These guys are all alliterative, like Wallace Waddle, Bruce Barton.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
That must mean they're like superheroes, like Peter Parker or,
That's right. Yeah, Bruce Barton was, every once in a while, was Batman. But anyway, so in 1925, this guy wrote a book. He was an advertising executive. He was a future Republican congressman. And he basically portrayed Christ as the prototype of the modern business executive. And here's a great quote. Here's a great quote. Quote, "He picked up 12 men from the bottom ranks of business and forged them into an organization that conquered the world." The apostles are reframed as like business executives.
Yeah, right.
It's like a corporate board.
Right.
It's so freaking great.
Oh, gosh.
God.
It reminds me of another book that came out a little bit later that I've actually read.
Oh.
So I think, I may be more into the positive thinking world than you guys are, because I did not read this ironically. This is, of course, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which, if you think about a book from 1936, I think that's still in the public knowledge.
Very popular,
people know about that book.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that. How? What did you find interesting about it?
So the main thing that I can remember from it, honestly, is he had this thing: make sure you remember everybody's birthday, like jot it down, and make sure you acknowledge.
You don't have
them
to anymore. Facebook tells you.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I think this is true. Like remembering your remember people's names, of course.
Yeah,
and
I
remember
feel that.
Their birthday. And this is actually, these are good tricks to help you connect with other people.
That's why I have no friends and I don't influence anyone.
Well, that's the thing. I think there's often you find nuggets of like, Well, yeah, of course. This is common valuable, sense. Useful this is good.
Well, that was my impression of the book, was that it had, you know, okay, here's some ideas for how to be socially apt in this world that we have. But the whole notion is, do that so that you become more wealthy and more prosperous and more. No, don't do it because you care about the person or you're kind of like.
Right.
That was the part that I had trouble with. It's like you don't want to be disingenuous when you're wishing someone a happy birthday. Don't do it just because Dale Carnegie tells you that's the way you're going to become rich.
Yeah, that is the irony. It's not like how to become a nice, reasonable human being that other people care about because you care about them. And you build a community and you love and respect and take care of each other. It's like, no, how to get rich because you remembered people's birthdays.
Right.
Well, I mean, I guess when I was a kid growing up, I remember on the little TVs we had.
Yeah.
There was this guy who was huge, Tony Robbins. I mean, literally
around.
Huge.
That dude's still around.
And he's still around. Oh, so yeah. I think he's in the same kind of universe as this Dale Carnegie and
So Tony Robbins, I looked it up. He's worth $600 million now.
Oh man!
And I got to tell
you guys, take that, Osteen.
Right. Yeah,
you're not thinking positive enough.
Right? Osteen. Yeah, Osteen needs to up his positive thinking. Maybe with the cube, though, he'll sell enough of those to catch up. But I got to tell you guys a quick story about, I didn't get to meet Tony Robbins, but I saw him in action at a conference. I did not go to a Tony Robbins conference. I went to a conference of the Society for Conservation Biology.
This is like the same conference hall?
Same conference hall. It was at the like the convention center in San Diego or something. Right.
And neither could fill it, so they had to double.
Yeah, they gave half the hall to the conservation biologists and half to the Tony Robbinsists.
Did you guys meet
over
coffee?
I'd love to see happy hour.
Did you meet over coffee?
Well, so where I would mingle with Tony Robbins people was like you'd go out for lunch or go out and get a coffee at a coffee shop and you'd see them. And it was so obvious who the conservation biologists were and who the Tony Robbins people were, because one of them had that weird Joel Osteen smile plastered on their face all the time. And the other one looked like the world was going to end. I actually, while I was there, I had this fantasy almost that, what if Tony Robbins ran the conference on conservation biology? So instead of talking about extinctions and this ecosystem's messed up and we're having trouble over here, I'd be more like, just walk on some coals and it'll all be fine.
Yeah, well, we did a conference, PCI organized a conference in 2020, basically about navigating the great unraveling. So it'd been wonderful to have Tony there to kind of be the keynote speaker for that.
MC that sucker.
That would have gone over really well. You know, all this stuff is, we talked about impact kind of within religion. We talked about it in business. And obviously, it's deeply embedded in sort of the whole industry around self-help stuff. It's been interesting to see Alana, who does a lot of the research for the season, she pulled together some like a list of bestsellers. And this, it seems like there's this cycle that happens every 20, 30 years. There's like a new big self-help book. Do you know what I mean? That hits. And as we talked about, there's some actually that are still persistent to this day that are selling well, even though they're published.
Dale Carnegie.
You know, decades and decades ago. I think some of our listeners might recognize maybe probably the most popular one in recent years. And that's a book called The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. Do you guys know about that book? Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it, but I've been afraid to look at it closely.
Just barely.
It's something that was really popularized by Oprah fucking Winfrey. I mean, she... sorry, but like...
You know, I didn't know that was her middle name. Oprah F. Winfrey, huh?
Yeah, she had the author on maybe more than once, kind of promoting this idea. Mm. Basically, the idea is very simple. Wish for it hard enough and it'll happen. You know, that's the secret.
Yeah.
Right?
When you wish upon a star...
And but actually telling, so what's interesting, the contrast maybe is there's a lot of useful stuff in this kind of positive thinking, self-help booky sort of realm, right? Like practical advice, things that are useful for people. But the idea that, oh, you just got to wish hard enough, pray hard enough, you know.
Let me just add, do you know when that was written by any chance?
I think it was, I don't know. 15 years ago?
Or something. Oh, okay, perfect, perfect. So that means on your 20-year cycle plan, we got 5 years to write the next one.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's then we're done. We're in the Joel Osteen, Tony Robbins, and whatever Rhonda, what is it, Rhonda Byrne? I'm sure she has millions too.
I think her thing hasn't even peaked yet. Yeah, they just made a movie with Katie Holmes.
Was she Tom Cruise's?
Yeah, like so she escaped Scientology, and now she's like doing this film that's like this sort of new thought.
That's a good way. Just go cult to cult, and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were talking earlier about how it's sort of libertarian, Christian, kind of more anti-government, right-wingy sort of stuff. This is more the prosperity gospel. You'll find it more in like Southern evangelical circles. But, you know, you can be on the left coast and you're not going to escape this stuff. New Age circles, the human potential movement. And I had this disturbing experience. I was in this little town called Willits in Northern California. And we had this one movie theater. And it was a wonderful place. I love this movie theater. And you could like ask them to play movies and they would sometimes go get it. I'm not kidding. They would just, oh, sure, yeah. So one of the movies I think that the community requested was What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
I saw that.
So
saw that?
Yeah.
I saw it in the theater, yeah. And I saw it with a bunch of people I knew.
I don't know what the bleep you guys are talking about.
Well, it's kind of about this woman who is a little depressed, a little, you know, anxious in life, just not sure what she wants out of life. And the next thing you know, it's getting into quantum physics and stuff. And I'm like, I'm watching this at first going, yeah, you know, I think you need to like realize that you can make a change, that you have power. You know, it sort of starts out slow and I'm with it. By the end though, I'm walking out and I'm going, depression and anxiety are debilitating and can manifest in all sorts of physical ways. And some positive thinking may really help pull folks out of a funk. And I'm asking my friends this. I'm like, but my God, can't we just recognize and accept that all that without misrepresenting quantum mechanics? Right. Like, why do they have to bring in quantum mechanics? I'm like, what are you talking about? This has nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
I can see this being just beyond upsetting for someone with your sensibilities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was about plus, like, the first 30 minutes of the movie, I'm with them. And then I'm like, what the hell are they doing here?
Well, and I bet you in a crazy town moment, like you're sitting there feeling all alone,
right?
Being everyone's critical.
Like, oh, everyone's like, ooh.
Oh, that totally explained it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you said, Jason, you know, this is, I mean, I think that film is part of a strain of positive thinking that's in maybe more kind of wellness, new age, kind of left coast circles, if you want to call it that. And, you know, we've seen this. There's a real history of it with Est, you know.
Yeah, in the Bay Area, Est.
In the Bay Area.
The Earnhardt Earhart Seminars Training, I think is what that stands for.
Yeah, and, you know, that led to, like, Landmark and these offerings, I think, that do provide a lot of benefit in many cases to people. It's just sometimes when you go a little bit too far in this idea that the physical world is just a manifestation of what we think.
You get too disconnected from reality is what happens sometimes.
Well, I like the way you state that because you can turn to the world of politics and see that as well. This idea of one political leader actually addressing reality, who turns out to be the loser, and another political leader who's like, fuck reality, let's look at the cool positive angle on this, who's the winner. And I'm, of course, referring to Carter and Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
So Jimmy Carter, as president, was really concerned about energy.
Yeah.
And the guy was a nuclear physicist, knew a thing or two about energy. He ended up giving these just disastrous, I should say disastrous politically, speeches.
Yeah.
One called the Crisis of Confidence speech. He had the one where he was wearing the sweater and telling everyone to turn down their thermostats.
What a bummer.
You know, and then Reagan comes in and goes, there you go again, you know, with his looking at reality, you loser. And he comes up with his, it's morning in America, you know, which really should have been spelled MOURNING, but you know what he was doing.
I know, I read the Carter transcripts and I go, oh, wow, this guy knew his stuff.
Yeah, he got it. And Reagan, of course, was an actor who was all about make-believe, and it made its way into our, you know, highest level, the highest office of our governance.
And I mean, you could just look in recent dynamics. Think about Trump.
I know where you're going.
Nope, I don't want to think about Trump.
Trump grew up attending Sunday services at the church of Norman Vincent Peale. Now, Peale wrote a book called The Power of Positive Thinking in the early 50s. That book spent 186 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
That's over 3 years. I just did the math. 3.5 years.
And he was spouting this prosperity gospel stuff, all this positive thinking stuff. This is not a side thing for Trump. I mean, he went there for almost 50 years. He married his first wife there at Peale's church. Of course,
Ivana, I believe.
One of those.
Yeah.
Of course, in true Trump fashion, he had to say that Peale thought, quote unquote, thought I was his greatest student of all time.
Well, that's thinking positively.
Exactly.
Okay. Look, we've kind of gone through, you know, right wing, left wing, politics, movies, books, all this stuff.
Business.
Yeah, business. Who can leave that out? But can we maybe start to distill what are really the impacts here? Like, what's the big deal?
I think the first thing is just to, and I think that's why we spent a little bit talking about the different manifestations of it, it's to really recognize that this is insidious throughout American society, right?
Yeah.
It's just permeated. And Barbara Ehrenreich in her book, I think, really put this succinctly. She said, positivity is not so much our condition or our mood as it is part of our ideology, right?
Yeah.
So it's like deeply, deeply embedded.
I think so. And that was very interesting insights from her, because she also made the connection between the prosperity gospel and the need to bolster consumerism. So here's a great quote from her. If early capitalism was inhospitable to positive thinking, late capitalism or consumer capitalism is far more congenial, depending as it does on the individual's hunger for more and the firm's imperative of growth. The consumer culture encourages individuals to want more. Cars, larger homes, television sets, cell phones, gadgets of all kinds, and positive thinking is ready at hand to tell them that they deserve more and can have it if they really want it and are willing to make the effort to get it. Well, I think we have to think of the timing of this. Like,
yeah.
I think we're talking for her, this is writing, I think, about sort of maybe the post-depression America, right? When we were coming out of the war and early capitalism was struggling to get people to consume enough.
Right.
So you have all the theories of Bernay, you know, the marketing stuff.
Yeah, creative advertising.
All of the examples we're giving of these writings are sort of at the cusp of that transition between the two.
Yeah.
So if positivity has become inherent in our society, I think there's a really huge downside for individuals, for each person. And that's this idea that success or failure is entirely dependent on you and your attitude, and it has nothing to do with society or circumstance. I mean, there's no doubt that your attitude and the amount of work that you put forth has something to do with what you can achieve, but this positive thinking deal says it's the only thing.
Yeah.
We've kind of reviewed a lot of books, but there was a really interesting one by Ralph Waldo, not Emerson, but Ralph Waldo Trine, came out just before the turn of the century to the 1900s. So this is in 1897,
okay.
called In Tune with the Infinite.
I hate it already.
I know, right? But the Amazon description of that book, so still available today,
okay,
says, "This is a must read for all who'd like to strengthen their connection to the infinite mind in order to enjoy a free flow of abundance, personal blessings, intuitive knowledge, and the strong sense of well-being that results from a solid connection."
Well, that's just more and more the same BS. So why is this book important?
Well, I mean, it's people like Henry Ford became a big fan of it, tried to incorporate it into the business practices and into how he ran his factories.
I mean, think about it.
Okay.
We have this is a huge schism in society where, you know, some people believe that it is the role of the collective, the state of society at large, to care for those who are disadvantaged, are hungry, are poor, lack education, whatever it is. And you have others who believe that it's really on the individual. If they're in a certain condition, it's not the system that put them there. It's not the structures of society. It's not racism, generational poverty, growing inequality issues. It's the fact that these people don't believe enough, or
they don't understand the law of attraction.
It's their fucking fault. Yeah, they just think differently. You know, their circumstances
can really lead to a callous way of approaching your neighbors.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I know. Well, I sort of feel this myself, right? Because I guess I'm kind of a Cassandra.
I call you that all the time.
Thank you. I look at the future and I'm very concerned about it. I'm trying to like raise some alarm about the situation. And, you know, I think I've gotten better at not doing it in ways that are off-putting and emotional, come with a lot of emotional baggage. But of course, anytime you say these sort of things, it's kind of a downer. Yeah, people get a little worried. But it's like in this culture, it's so hard to get any traction with that. Like, can you please deal with this reality I see in front of me? And you're just kind of brushed aside as some freaking Chicken Little or something.
Or demanded that you have an answer to solve it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Give us something positive. Tell us what to do, right?
Yeah.
If you even dare to bring up a problem.
I'd love to tell you what to do, but it's a collective action problem. And until like most of us actually recognize the problem, there's not much that you can do as an individual, which of course goes against this whole notion that individuals have the power to change the freaking world.
That's, of course, brought up in the movie Don't Look Up, where, you know, they're on the morning show and the morning people are like, oh, we got to talk about the positive stuff. And he's like, we're all going to fucking die here soon. You realize that, don't you?
It's over, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier about Trump being steeped in this, you know, stuff, you know, going to Peel's church. And some people have written about this, talked about this, but, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's easy to look back in hindsight and say, oh, I should have known this, should have known that. But Trump was incredibly dismissive. I mean, he was like, oh, it'll be gone by this time. We'll be gone by this time. We're going to like knock this thing out. And,
right.
And I think it feels really plausible to me to see how being steeped in this sort of positive thinking would lead him in that situation to be like, la.
So it goes beyond sort of this political calculation of, I don't want it to be recognized. I want the markets to stay up. I want my, it's more like, if I actually deny it's happening, maybe it will stop happening.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. It's at that level.
And the consequence is to some degree, lives lost.
Yeah, the consequence is you don't deal with the problem or the challenge that's in front of you.
You can't get stakes that are higher than that if you think about the impact of this.
And stuff. I think about it on the interpersonal level. So, you know, you imagine somebody who's got cancer, let's say, and it's at a late stage, but they're not allowed, if they're in a certain culture, a subculture, they're not allowed to have negative thoughts. And the people around them, their friends and family, don't want to entertain the pain they're in and don't want to look at it closely. Because with the idea being like, oh, maybe if they only have positive thoughts, they'll cure themselves. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of that out there, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's super damaging because you're starting to deny your mortality and deny the ability for you to go through a grief process and come to some sort of state of acceptance and have really difficult but important conversations with your friends and family.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of this just removes some of the most important things to happen in someone's life, which is going through a death process with grace.
Yeah, and taking the meaning out of it. As everyone around you has that Joel Osteen smile plastered all the time, and rather than talking about what's really there.
Yeah. I think we also have to recognize that positive thinking could be really overt, or it could be, you know, sort of under the radar. Can absolutely be used as a tool of social and political control. I mean, the sort of extreme example of that is if you look at authoritarian dictatorships, like
lipstick on a pig kind
of thing. North Korea, right. You know, where people are literally starving, suffering from famine, and they're being told that they have to sing songs about how they're the greatest nation in the history of the world. But you have that, I think, certainly in U.S. culture. I mean, we just talked about that with Carter. Like, you are punished for speaking at all negatively or critically about anything, you know?
Well, and look at what it enables you to do, too. You can do something as great as deny climate change, right? I mean, that's just the Chicken Littles. That's just the Jason Bradfords of the world telling you stuff that that it may not even be true. And it's just an easy way out. You know, you can even take it to a level where you know, let's say you actually believe the science behind climate change, but positive thinking maybe will protect you and your family from this problem.
It actually, if you look at the conversations within the climate science community, you know, when you look at plans that nations have developed, you look at plans that others, you know, academics, researchers have developed, you know, there is a kernel of this positive thinking in every one of those practically, because like, look at their reliance to try to get the levels down to, you know, try to keep us from going past 1.5 degrees C warming or two or whatever it is. There's this magical solution that comes in, negative emissions technology, some ways of sucking carbon out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That are not established.
They're just bullshit. Yeah.
You know, that's positive thinking.
It is.
We're going to fucking figure this thing out to make this math work.
Or the Canadians being like, oh, well, you know, the Corn Belt's going to move up into our latitudes. Yay! And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait a second, fire's everywhere.
And it's 120 degrees today.
That's hot.
It's actually Popcorn Belt now.
It pops on the stalk. In the field. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, I also sort of see this lately in this sort of constant rush to get rich quick without even trying, right? The whole notion that you can make money by just parking some of your money somewhere that magically explodes and becomes the next big thing.
Yeah.
The stock market, you know, people looking for stock tips, etc. Now, crypto.
Matt Damon.
Yeah, exactly.
NFT shit.
Yeah, all right. Never mind the fundamentals that this is just an entropy sink with not really much social value to back it up, but people are piling on.
Matt Damon.
He's shilling for that stuff.
Can you pull up his cryptocurrency clip?
Sure, yeah, we can do that.
Come on.
The ones who embrace the moment and commit. And in these moments of truth, these men and women, these mere mortals, just like you and me, as they peer over the edge, they calm their minds and steel their nerves with four simple words that have been whispered by the intrepid since the time of the Romans. Fortune favors the brave.
Fortune favors those who buy into cryptocurrency before everyone else rushes in and it crashes.
Fortune favors those who get out before the music stops.
Think positively, be brave, take risks, and stick money in something that makes no sense.
Well, it is so true. Like, you look at, in some ways, actually, venture capital and kind of like all the sort of new technology shit that goes out there. A lot of that is like...
Yeah.
It will work out someday. I mean, Theranos, the story of Theranos, fascinating story, is a perfect example of that. I mean, this company, you know, with this...
The Stanford grad.
Was basically saying, we can create this incredible equipment technology that will allow you to, like, test blood for all of these things with a little pinprick, and we could do it overnight. The fucking technology didn't work, but she was just selling it, getting all this money in the door. And she actually, I think, really believed, we'll figure that out. Mm. It'll get solved.
Well, that's because she hired David Blaine and David Copperfield as her lead research team. You know, you just apply the magic.
Well, she had people on her staff being like, this doesn't work. And she's like, nope, we're going for it.
Right.
It's going to work out.
Well, let's kind of summarize this. You know, I think you can go back to the concepts that we've talked about of culture materialism. And you can understand what this whole crazy positive thinking, new thoughtism, as a natural consequence of all this industrial productivity coming online. And then the push for consumerism. And we're needing a society that is historically puritanical Christian nation is needing some kind of justification to suddenly just start buying stuff and making their dreams come true. You know, you have this agrarian culture that we were that had little material wealth to go around. And hedonism and sinful wants were bad. You had to stuff those down, right? But now we have factories churning out cheap junk, and we're told to embrace our material cravings, and God will provide.
And there's a really interesting, I think, sort of extreme tension here, because we're told that we need to be good consumers. This puts a veneer on all that. But at the same time, we've seen that this is unfulfilling to people.
Yeah.
So they become more and more deeply unfulfilled because it actually doesn't fill what people need. They need community, connection, meaning, purpose, beauty in life, right? And so the more they chase after that shit and are told, think positively and you can get all these riches, and then they either don't achieve them, and that means that there's something wrong with them, or they get them and they're unfulfilled. That's also something wrong with them. Think harder.
Okay, Chicken Little, just send me some money and everything's going to be just peachy keen.
If you send PCI massive donations, nothing will happen to you.
Hey, Jason and Cher, you guys have both been invited to be guests on Rachel Donald's great podcast, Planet Critical. What do you think of that?
Great interview, yeah.
Sorry, Rob, are you feeling left out?
Well, I was kind of wondering, like, you guys are on there. Some of the other people that we love, like Nate Hagen's been interviewed. I want to be on Planet Critical.
You're the only one who hasn't written a book between us. Yeah, I mean, just kidding.
I'm going to go in the corner and cry now.
No, just write another book, Rob.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'll do. Yeah. I'll start a campaign to get on Planet Critical.
No, her podcast is great. I think Rachel does a great job. I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate the podcast she does. She's spoken with a lot of folks that I think people who are definitely steeped and familiar with PCI would be familiar with. David Orr, and you mentioned Nate, and Josh Farley, and others.
And don't let our show... And the fact that she interviewed Cher and I
take away from the fact
that she has a lot of good guests.
Good point. Questionable judgment there, Rachel, on picking these two clowns for your show.
I was remarkably articulate when she interviewed me. I have no idea. I have no idea how that happened.
You had a ringer sitting in for you. Huh?
I don't think it was me speaking. I think I was speaking in tongues. Like I got the spirit, and it just kind of.
Good. Well, listeners, avoid that episode. But otherwise, go check out Planet Critical, Rachel Donald, a podcast for a world in crisis.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Okay, so I guess to start with thinking about doing the opposite here, we just need to acknowledge that if people are actually listening to this podcast, they probably haven't really fallen deeply into the religion of positive thinking.
Great, right? So we're not talking to anybody is what you're saying.
No, I'm just... I know our people. We hear from them, right? Yeah. And they're... I would say they're overly susceptible to that stuff. But I think we have to be careful, and I include the three of us here... to not fall into the trap of seeing everything in the negative light.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Yeah.
Because I don't know that that's the do the opposite.
Well, right. So the opposite of positive thinking, despite maybe your natural state of affairs, Asher, is not negative thinking, right? It's actually being realistic. It's critical thinking.
Yeah.
Again, going back to Barbara Ehrenreich in her book, Bright Sided, she said the alternative... is to try to get outside of ourselves and see things as they are, or as uncolored as possible by our own feelings and fantasies. And, you know, we talked about cognitive bias in the past and all these different ways that we can sort of accidentally filter the world in wrong ways. And she's saying, try to be aware of that and think critically. And that's really what you need to do to counteract some of this... some of this positive thinking that's been embedded in our culture.
I try to say to myself, try to discover or uncover what is, not what you want things to be. Mm-hmm. See the world not as you want it to be, but as it is. And that will give you then maybe a stepping stone, a way to realistically assess how you can shift it more towards what you want it to be. I also, doing the opposite is also... not believing that our thoughts, feelings don't have an impact on our health or well-being. They absolutely do. I have plenty of experience and know people with anxiety and depression who manifest these things physically.
Absolutely.
And part of what you try to do is kickstart like a process of of getting out of those negative ruminations and laying down new tracks in your mind. And when you start to do that and become more grounded in reality and not spiraling into these negative thoughts, you often get a health benefit. So I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, and I think to both of your points, this is about avoiding any extreme, dogmatic, rigid, singular way of looking at the world, right? Like the problem with positive thinking is not that you're being positive about stuff. It's that you're expecting yourself to only be positive about things and that will somehow change the result or of the world around you. The same thing would be true about thinking about everything, you know, completely negatively,
yeah,
or thinking that your mind doesn't impact your body or whatever, right? But
given that this positive thinking is out there and embedded in the culture, and we went through a ton of examples, what can we tell listeners about how to challenge that
if you
society?
See it, right?
Yeah, it actually, that's something that Barbara Ehrenreich wrote about in her book as well, which is it is incumbent upon all of us to challenge blind positivity around us. And I would actually even caution us to challenge blind negativity, right?
Yeah,
or fatalism as well. And it's not doing it by calling people stupid, even though this is, you know, I think people could like look at us and be like, look, you guys just spent an hour doing that, you know, but because it's so tempting, I got to say. We're actually not, I would like to say, we're not mocking the stupidity of the people who are susceptible to these messages. We are mocking the people who take advantage of people's susceptibility to this stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But engaging people to think more critically is not calling them dumb or wrong about stuff. It's asking them to think critically and actually recognize that we actually practice defensive pessimism in life, mm-hmm, you know, on a regular basis. So like, think about it. You know, you're driving in a car and you're not just, hopefully, you're not just assuming everyone's got their shit together and they're, you know, there's no chance that anyone's going to ever come into your lane or run a light or whatever it is, right? And of course, we practice defensive pessimism because we wouldn't exist anymore as a species if we weren't like careful.
Right.
You know?
Right. Don't let your kids just run out into the street.
Exactly. As a parent, we're constantly doing that stuff, you know?
Yeah. Vigilance.
Yeah. And so it's just maybe it's engaging in conversation with them and say, look, thinking critically, exploring possibility that things might not turn out perfectly, that if we don't just hope that they're going to be okay and believe that they're going to be okay, it's okay to do that. We do that in life in all kinds of small ways. Let's look at some of the larger issues that we're facing in that same
life.
Yeah, have
defensive pessimism, right?
Okay, cool. But I'm going to queue up Matt Damon and have some fortune favoring the bold here. Defensive pessimism.
I lost you there, didn't I?
Yeah.
We want to give a special thanks to Ilana Zuber, our star researcher of the watershed moments through history. Without her work, there's no way we could have covered such sweeping topics this season.
Yeah, and we also want to thank our other outstanding volunteers. Anya Steyer provides original artwork for us, and Taylor Antal prepares the transcripts for each episode.
And a big, big thank you to our producer, Melanie Travers, who helps us bozos stay professional.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners. If you want to help others find their way to Crazy Town, please drop us a 5-star rating and hit that share button when you hear an episode you like.
Hey guys, instead of introducing a sponsor for today's podcast, I actually want to talk about the fact that PCI is actually, Post Carbon Institute, is sponsoring today's episode.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, you know, this Inspiration Cube that we talked about earlier, Joel Osteen's thing, that's a friggin' cash cow, man.
It's a great idea.
Yeah,
I think our listeners are going to want to hear our Inspiration
Cube. Yeah, I think we can rake in some bucks if we create our own cube.
Yeah, so.
Isn't it called the Reality Cube?
Yeah, I think we can call it the Crazy Town Cube, Reality Cube. We got to workshop
this. The Crazy Town Reality Cube.
Okay.
It's going to have awesome messages for anybody that purchases this for $17.99.
Yeah.
You know, like I really liked that one. I hit the button and it said, hey, today is your day. Get out there and build that survival bunker you've always wanted.
Oh, that's great. Get people motivated to really take action. Well, I have one of my favorites says, after you die, this is me, I get to narrate this. After you die, you won't even know you are dead. So relax, it's okay.
Yeah, and mine is, yeah, it's true. Your brother, he's got a bigger house, you know, nicer car or whatever. But he's an asshole.
365 days of crazy like town realism.
This will change your life.
Crazy town. Da, 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 crazy town.